what we do and don't have in the way of wild creatures in urban areas is on my far right, Michael McKinney, who is a professor at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He holds a PhD from Yale University and currently is the director of the Environmental Studies Program. He also teaches environmental geology and an introductory course in environmental science. Is faculty advisor to the Student Environmental Club, and his current research interests are in urban aquatics and plants, as I recall. Yes, yes. And next to me, you've probably already guessed this from the uniform, is Joe McSpadden, who is a law enforcement officer with the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency, where he has been for 3 years. He holds a bachelor's degree in wildlife and fisheries from Tennessee Tech. And Professor McKinney is here to cover the broad picture, and Joe is here to talk about the wild creatures and the people he has to deal with. He's sort of on the other end of things. So let me just start with a very broad question for Professor McKinney. Oh, I should say that typically we have talks and then Q&A, and since this is such a small, cozy group, I think we'll just do questions. So if you have one, raise your hand. If I don't see you, say something, and we'll just have a conversation. I'm not, this is too small a group to be really formal. So tell me, Michael, what do urban areas look like in terms of biodiversity? Have we lost a lot? Are they tending to become their own little sort of specialized biological areas?
That's a really good question. The short answer is they're actually really diverse. A lot of people see cities as biological deserts, but we're finding more and more that cities are actually refuges for a lot of species. It obviously depends on what species you are. I'm sure Joe can address this, but for example, if you're a raccoon or a possum or a skunk, you're going to have a high population density and be quite happy in a city. And it's especially true for plants. If you just look at the number of species in a place like New York City or Atlanta or even Knoxville, you find many more species of plants per square mile than you do, say, out in the woods. And obviously that's because people, cultivate and bring in plants. But that's a surprise to people that cities are very diverse for many groups. And I think it has a lot of implications, too. I think the reason I'm interested in it is because, A, it's a place where maybe we can help conserve endangered species if they can get along with people. And, B, it's a great place to educate people about biodiversity because if you're disconnected from nature, you're not going to be interested in conserving nature. And since 80% of people live in cities, which is most people, that's a great place to cultivate an ethic of stewardship.
So, Joe, when you're dealing with people, do you find a lot of them are, let's see, I don't want to be too stereotypical, but do you find that a lot of the people you deal with are born and raised in cities or almost entirely, and so they don't really know how to deal with the wild creatures they're complaining to you about?
Well, typically, yes, and if with the biodiversity in the cities and the lack of the diversity, sometimes because of the lack of some of our game species and the people in the cities would lack some of the education that to understand why they may see certain animals or not. So a lot of what we'll deal with is education of those public on why essentially you have certain species as raccoons, possums, skunks, squirrels, certain species of birds. Those animals essentially thrive, and we educate people they thrive in cities because of the lack of predator animals, such as your coyotes and your hawks and things aren't so prevalent in a city because of the large buildings and such. They cannot find good perches to prey upon those small game animals or small mammals.
Do you find that there is a difference between the really urban areas? I should mention that Joe handles Hamilton County, which is right here. I forgot to say that. So do you find that there's a difference between what you deal with in the city or in the really urban areas versus out in the suburbs to whatever extent Chattanooga has them? I mean, you have equal numbers of calls, equal numbers of troubles, different kinds of troubles, one area to the next?
Yes, at times the calls can be based upon that. It all falls upon the education of the individual who places the call to us. They may know some about wildlife, or they may not. So just because there's someone in the city does not necessarily say that, essentially, I guess, to clarify my last question, that doesn't essentially mean that they're not going to know what's there, and the call, it's going to vary. It doesn't vary, so it depends on the individual that the call is given to, or given to me, the education of the person. So they may say, I have a problem with wildlife. And depending on their degree, that I get to talk to them, say, well, what is the problem? Some people actually have a physical problem. It's in their house. Or some people say, well, I have a problem. I have seen said animal. Well, that's not necessarily a problem. Let me speak to you why you have seen that and why you're seeing that animal. So that's not necessarily, it's not the city or in the county. I usually, it just depends on the person who calls and their understanding maybe of the habits of that animal. So that's where I stress to them, that's what my job is, to stress to them, to educate them, say that, well, you're seeing a coyote right now in your yard at this time because.
Yeah, give us an example. Or two of them.
We spoke about that. I'll talk about the call I had the other day here, just actually yesterday. Lady had called and says, I have a coyote problem. I said, I returned her call, and I said, I received your call. Said you had a problem with some coyotes. Well, yes, I saw one in my yard. I said, well, okay, it's natural to see a coyote in this part of the state, in this part of the area, you know, here in Hamilton County. And I said, was it giving you any issues? Of course, I believe she had lost her cats to the coyote, or she believed that she did. And she wanted to know why they may be there, and contributed to me understanding that there had been a tornado and some damage, and that's why that it pushed them out of their natural habitat to her yard. I said, oh, well, ma'am, you're seeing those, and education of her continued to say, well, you're seeing them because probably the tornado damage actually did not push them out, but increased a lot of habitat that was favorable for rabbits, mice, rats, chipmunks, small animals, which the coyote preys upon. So he is coming over towards your yard since they bordered that damage to their yard. He's coming up in there as a good zone and a good area to hunt. I said, that's the reason you're really seeing him. So that tornado actually increased your chances of seeing him. And once we tell those people that, we'll prey upon small dogs, small cats, and such, but the reason essentially the whole basic conversation, to educate her on why she saw them. And once I did that, her problem with that animal was gone.
Now, that's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. Michael, how quickly do animals move into an area? I mean, you know what Joe said about the tornado damage creating more habitat for squirrels and chipmunks? How fast does that happen? I mean, it strikes me as, when I think about that sort of biological settlement process, I'm thinking in terms of years as animals discover a new territory and move into it. Am I wrong?
Well, that might be a better question for Joe, but I mean, typically these animals, they're called commensals. These are species that have evolved to live with humans, really. You know, you go back to cats and dogs. I mean, we cultivated them and domesticated them. And increasingly, a lot of species are finding out they can have a good life if they move into the cities. But most of these animals have lived with humans for decades or even centuries, farms and increasingly in the cities. But the actual, you know, if you take a skunk in my backyard, that lineage of skunk is probably been around for decades, so it's been a long ongoing process.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
It's tough.
And repeat the question, if you would, please, so we can get on the recording.
I mentioned cities might serve as refuges for endangered species, especially in Europe, which, of course, has a long history of human habitation. They're actually finding that you can have conservation gardens and butterfly gardens as part of urban networks and urban park systems. Mostly they would include things like plants and butterfly species in urban areas. Here in the U.S., the examples I'm familiar with include in California and San Francisco. There's several different species of plants and also butterflies that live in San Francisco and are doing pretty well. So it's a really cool idea.
Is there a minimum sort of size that you need? I mean, is it possible to string together a bunch of backyards and provide an adequate habitat for some creature that you want to conserve?
In theory. There have been papers published on that, and they actually are trying to do that in the UK. But in practice, I think it's been hard to implement because of the way people operate. It's hard to take a bunch of a neighborhood and tell people to leave this land alone for species. But in theory, yeah.
And before I take your question, that is a good place to drop in our third panelist, who could not be here because he's a federal employee. We were going to have Scott Cahan, who is chief of the wildlife refuge system for the Northeast region from Fish and Wildlife, and he has a particular interest in urban wildlife refuges, which he was going to talk about, except the government is shut down and now he can't travel. So if you are intending to do a story on that, I can certainly supply his contact information, or you can look it up. Now, your question.
On the spring cities and the diversity of plants and things like that, are you all at all worried about possibility of invasive species and how that may affect the wilding or rewilding of our cities? And, you know, are we interested in rewilding or are we keeping the natural biodiversity here? Or, you know, can you all speak to some of those issues that may arise with wilding the cities?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
And the question is?
No, I'm sorry. How do we deal with invasive species, and how does that fit into this business of biodiversity in the city? That's a really good question because I was just down at Third Creek in Knoxville, which is a restored creek, and they spent $1.1 million to restore that creek. And the guy who restored it was showing me around, and I noticed that, you know, probably two-thirds of the species down there are invasive plants and even animals, too. And I mentioned that, and he said, well, I think the basic idea right now is we just want green space, and we just want biodiversity. We don't care where it's from. And so that is a huge question because, one, just to give you both sides of the argument, a lot of people argue that ecosystem function is all we care about, and that means we don't care if it's invasive or not. And then you have people like me who are more conservation-minded, and I would much prefer native species. And that would include endangered species as well. So there's this big argument between invasives, which are better than no species at all, or do you really want the real thing, which is native species? And it's definitely a big debate about that.
So, Joe, do you run into any of that with your practice? I mean, you have people keeping, you know, Burmese pythons as have escaped in Florida into the Everglades?
Well, yes, and I was actually hoping I could elaborate on this question a little bit, which is essentially in the wildlife field, more specifically to our wild animals and our management of that, is a huge issue. There are some plant species, for instance, kudzu. That is an invasive species. We've all seen kudzu, and is there. The European starling, feral hogs from Russia, all these animals that some have been brought over or introduced in a management standpoint from our agency is essentially a management nightmare. All of our biodiversity, all of our animals that are native to this country, all have those limiting factors which keep those animals and populations in check. Kudzu and things that where it was it naturally was from had those limiting factors such as seasons or temperature, moisture, and things. So here, introducing something like an invasive species to, say, hold a bank of soil to a highway to, well, maybe we want something, we'll introduce this because it does really well here, so we want to see that, is not necessarily good from a wildlife management standpoint because it displaces the native species. It can, so there's, therefore, we lose habitat, we lose some of our area, that refuge or living space for that animal, because now we've introduced something that has nothing to prey upon it or to halter, hinder its growth.
Or the animal can't feed on it, and so it goes into somebody's backyard where it can.
Uh-huh. Actually, if I could just elaborate.
Go right ahead, yes.
I've actually written several papers and a book on biological homogenization. Okay. And a real important aspect of invasive species is not just the local destruction and management issues that they cause, but if you replace native species in Milwaukee or Atlanta or Berlin with, you know, the same subset of non-natives that we find all over the planet, like wherever you go in the world, you'll see starlings and you'll see house sparrows and you'll see kudzu and dandelions, then we're eventually going to homogenize the planet, which is really the opposite of what biodiversity is all about. So so that's an aesthetical aspect to this that I think is really worth mentioning. Because cities homogenize the planet faster than anything else that people do. We tend to plant the same flowers, and city governments plant the same street trees, and so if you go to San Francisco or Denver or any city, you'll often see the same species and Bradford pear trees and so on. And that's something that a lot of us who care about biodiversity don't like to see.
In the back.
We can segue a bit from the science to the politics and policy. I'm an environmental journalist at Michigan State. Michigan has lots and lots and lots and lots of deer. It has lots and lots and lots of Canada geese, and they've spent lots and lots and lots of time in gardens and golf courses and on the beaches and all. And different municipalities deal with it in different ways. So some townships that are close to urban areas may have a limited hunting season just for deer, just in the municipal parks. We poison the geese, do we shoot the geese? So on a broader level, what do you see happening nationally as communities confront the constituent demand, get them out of here, with the biological fact that they're there and the problems are coming back?
And the question, to summarize, is across the nation, how are we handling the problem of geese and other creatures that are in urban places where humans don't want them? Is that a fair summary? Okay.
It's probably good
okay.
for you.
Okay, who wants that one?
I'll elaborate and answer that one, hope, and to the best of my ability, I hope. In the state here, in Tennessee, our main, probably the most out there in front, prevalent way of handling that is our hunting seasons. Along with our invasive species, that gives us an idea of how prevalent they are and how prolific something may be is how much we'll set a hunting season on. So, say we have a lot of geese, we have a lot of deer. Something we deal with all the time is our deer population and our vehicle accident numbers. How many? Okay, so in Hamilton County, for instance, for example, last year I added another hunting date for deer for a. Say for a female, it's called a non-quota hunt, so someone can harvest another female species to help try to keep that population down. Also in geese, our numbers, we allow more laxed hunting bag limits so they can harvest more to be able to help keep that population down. So we find that if we allow a species such as Canada geese, as we touched on earlier, cities harbor great can act as great refuges. Canada geese like to eat on grass and greens and love park settings and city settings, urban settings. Like I said earlier, they're away from predation and away from hunting. So we may see an increase in hunting bag limits, so therefore that the people and the small amount of people that are hunting those animals, deer and Canada geese, can harvest more, that so we can counteract the increase of maybe the urban refuge system.
Yeah, I'm going to toss in something. You may or may not be aware, Fish and Wildlife had a series of rules that they approved, that's a good question, now, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, maybe a little more, about measures to control geese, covering eggs with oil or just shaking them when they're in the nest. And I was doing a story on that, and when I was talking to a Wisconsin DNR biologist, he said, we have created perfect goose habitat in our cities, because if you think about the normal subdivision, there's a stormwater, big stormwater retention pond, which provides water for the geese to retreat to, and everybody clips the lawns down so the geese can see any threat that's coming, and it produces nice, tender shoots of grass that they can feed on. So, you know, if you're a goose, why wouldn't you settle there? So, Dr. McKinney, why don't you, want to throw in a thought on changing the habitat?
I guess I do have a good anecdote. I think it's a great question, because I run into this all the time, this tension between people who like animals and people who also know enough about nature that they know how many is too many and so on. But I had a girl that came into my class one day that she had found a starling that she would that was sick and on the side of the road, and she took it to the vet and tried to pay a couple $100 to get the starling fixed up. And so I tried to explain to her about this is nature, but it's not the kind of nature you think it is. And so there's absolutely a real tension between people who love animals and they see one animal and that's all they see. It's cute and cuddly. And then the rest of us who look at the whole ecosystem, and this animal is actually very destructive and harmful and causes a lot of problems. And that's a big problem in the cities.
Yes, go ahead.
Starlings, I feel like, are sort of an interesting example, because I don't imagine many people want to shoot them. There's not like a hunting season for starlings, and starlings are actually kind of pretty when they get all colorful and spotty. And there's probably not a ton of awareness that this is actually an invasive species. I mean, is there a management plan for starlings? What do you do with starlings?
Okay, question is, what do we do with something like a starling, which is just there, and how do you manage it?
The active way of managing that right now for the agency is to open a season, which it's open to harvest or to shoot or hunt that animal. And like it is just with our native species, they're controlled, but they're more laxed upon an invasive species such as that. Example here, kind of recently, we may know of the sandhill cranes. Here, just recently, for the first time in the state's history, we just opened a sandhill crane hunting season, which will take place here coming the end of this year. Its population gained to the size that it is becoming problematic for some of our agricultural and our farms in the area. And after, of course, we take our surveys and say, is the population healthy enough to sustain a harvest or a hunting season? And once we get the information back from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and our biologists, then they implement that, you know, a hunting season that says, well, we can harvest, say, 400 permits per person and 3 birds per person. Okay, and the European starling, like I mentioned, there's nothing that's going to prey upon it naturally. It's a invasive species. So therefore, if we don't actively manage it, that's our goal, is to hopefully allow people. But we find that people don't really have a need to, because it doesn't provide a really big meal. It doesn't. So why do that? So it is a challenge. So for management, from a management standpoint, and of course their numbers are ever increasing. But that right now is the active management, or to hope that there is some predation from some species, but those numbers do not match. Hawks, ancipiter species such as kestrels, Cooper's hawks, things that will prey upon those other birds and those European starling, but they don't prey upon it probably fast enough. So that's our active management goal right now, is just to allow people to harvest those and hunt those.
Go on.
I know that some cities, the main thing that they do is they use loud noises and cannons to scare them off. They don't really try to kill them or exterminate them. The big thing is just to get them to live somewhere else. I know on our campus at UT we had a big problem. They roost and they poop on everything. And what they did was they put these nets over the trees where they would roost, and they couldn't land there, and they went somewhere else. So basically it's a not-in-my-backyard issue for most cities. That's how they handle it. And, of course, if they start exterminating them, it gets in the newspaper really fast and it gets a lot of bad press. I know the sheriff's office down the road was using them for target practice, and that got in the newspapers real fast. Didn't last long.
In a border county like this, animals don't stay still. So how do you deal with the state next to you, or the county north of you or west of you? When that population can move so easily, especially birds.
Well, with each county, luckily the state has that one model of management. Or to scare, I should have mentioned, but the Sandhill Cranes, they had the propane cannons for a while to scare off animals, and we would give those to farmers to say, here, put these in your field and scare them off, because there wasn't a season. But for state to state, it poses a challenge. That state may vote to have a different type of management practice. They may say, well, we don't want this animal. We may want to enjoy seeing this animal, but yes, we understand that we need to control its population, or, for instance, we won't have any more state bird in Tennessee's the mockingbird. We won't have a mockingbird anymore. You know, depending on what that animal eats, let's say, for instance, the subject being starling and what it preys upon, what it eats, it's taking away from someone else. So another bird. That species that's not going to be able to thrive. So that is a strong management transport. We have our meetings and our conferences that we will go across our biologists, talk to our other biologists in other states. Unfortunately, I'm in the law enforcement division, so my management is, how do I keep a law infraction from happening? And I will, if I have right now, I have an issue that's going on in Georgia and Tennessee. So we contact that reciprocal state or that other state and say, hey, man, let's get together and decide our best option across the state, hands across the borders. Let us, what works for you and what worked for me, so we can take care of that species, so to speak.
Okay, Professor McKinney, talk a little bit about aquatics, which is your specialty. And I mean, we had an evening at the Tennessee Aquarium yesterday. And what's the state of waterways in general, urban ponds?
Yeah,
define it how you wish.
Brought that up. That's a great question, because your typical urban creeks are a very polluted, soupy mess, and yet that's actually where a lot of biodiversity is. Natural ecosystems, ducks, fish, clams, they all occur only in these creeks. It's also where a lot of your greenways are and a lot of your parks. So there's a lot of biodiversity there, but it's usually in the context of a really polluted and disturbed environment. I guess the short answer is it's a real good example of ecosystem function, because if you go to a creek around here, actually just out of curiosity, does anybody know what kind of the only kind of clam you'll find in a local city creek? Well, it's a mussel, but what species? Yeah, so it's a great example of an invasive situation. Tennessee has more clams than the entire continent of Europe. If you look at things like elephant ears, they're usually these really giant, awesome clams, but they can't live in cities because they can't tolerate the pollution. So what we have instead are these little tiny Asian clams. They're not really zebra mussels, which is something separate, but the Asian clams are probably what you'll see if you live in any city. They're these little tiny clams that came from Asia, and they can tolerate pollution. So people see those and they think, well, it's an invasive species, we need to kill it and get rid of it and manage it. But the reality is those clams are doing an important job, because they're filtering the water where no native clam can live. So I actually... I think that's a good example of an urban management situation where you probably want to let it do its thing, and it helps the fishing, and it helps remove water pollution, and it's doing a good job. So that's
a good example.
So the zebra mussels that everyone has been complaining about in the Great Lakes for several years, which can filter something like a liter a day, one little mussel, are in a sense not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, no, that illustrates the complexity of these issues. The zebra actually has the bad habit of gluing itself to the muscles, to the shells of other muscles, and because it has the super glue, it clogs up outtake pipes and causes a lot of economic damage. If it wasn't for that, it would probably be a better thing. But the Asian clam doesn't do any of that. The Asian clam is pretty harmless, and so the zebra, I would say, probably has to be eradicated just because of that bad habit of gluing itself to other muscles. But yeah, urban aquatic systems could potentially be cleaned up for fishing. You know, if you go to an urban or a typical city, you'll see, you know, kids walking in the water and playing in the local creeks. And in Knoxville, it's really polluted. It's really bad. It's got E. coli and things like that. So, you know, one of the issues I think that we haven't talked about is, you know, what do you do about these polluted aquatic ecosystems in the cities? And because if you clean them up, again, if you go to Europe or some of these cities that are kind of farther down the road with their urban ecosystems, you will see people fishing and swimming in these creeks because they've cleaned them up. So I think a big issue that I at least want to mention is that the cities really need to invest heavily, a lot more heavily, in the watershed management area and focus on cleaning up these creeks and the wetlands. You guys hear a lot about wetlands all the time. In Knoxville, again, you know, Turkey Creek wetland was the big one, and they converted that into the biggest mall in Knox County. So there again is an issue where you need to focus more heavily on maybe watershed management and wetlands and less on economic development.
Well, and how easy or how realistic is it to clean up city watersheds when you have all of the urban runoff, you know, the old industrial waste and the fertilizers which people pour on their lawns, which create algae blooms and things like that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there's a misconception that they're just hopeless and you can't do anything. But the reality is, if you invest in the infrastructure, you can actually clean up those systems significantly. You can actually have a pretty clean watershed to the point where people can actually utilize it and swim and fish. But the real issue is just economics. How much do people want to spend to do that? And that's where you don't see much interest.
So tell me, Joe, what's the biggest problem that you have? I mean, I keep straying to the little book he brought along here, which is the Tennessee Rabies Call Referral Protocol.
Okay.
And you were saying before we started that you get a lot of raccoon calls.
Right. As I mentioned earlier, that in this county particularly, and in several parts of, it seems like, of an urban area, the raccoon takes a lot of precedence over a lot of other things. I mentioned, and we used the analogy, I said that we call that the little bear, and because people, it's essentially, that's its actions are just mimic exactly that of what you would find in a bear in a national park or in the Smoky Mountains. They like to get into trash. They like to get into people's homes, in their drainage culverts, and they posed us a little bit of a management issue on how to, earlier, like I said, either educate someone about it or to give them the advice of how to take care of it. Now, the book per se is the Rabies Call Referral Protocol. Yes, rabies, you know, like other wildlife species, can carry different types of diseases. The rabies is one that the raccoon is the vector of. It is one of our vector species, along with skunks and foxes, can carry the rabies virus. We haven't had a case. The USDA Wildlife Services, I talked to them. We haven't had a case in Hamilton County since 1998, but we remain to be in the vector zone, which they continue to actively manage by placing bait stations. Now, our role on when a call comes in, we want to know whether someone has been exposed, whether they've been scratched, or whether they've been bitten by a raccoon. They say, okay, I have a raccoon. I found a, for instance, a baby raccoon, and I picked that baby raccoon up because I wanted to help it. Baby raccoon can carry the rabies virus and not exhibit the symptoms. There's even an adult cannot exhibit symptoms. We think sometimes rabies, though, they're going to be mad or they're going to be foaming at the mouth, and not necessarily. So if someone has been exposed, we have a protocol that we need to contact the health department in case a quarantine has to be made. They need to be screened to see whether or not there's a chance that contracted rabies, as well as the animal taken and tested for rabies. Like I said, the chances now are not really high. We haven't had a case since 1998 here in this county. But depending on whether or not there's been exposure, we have different levels where we'll say, okay, leave it alone, which is the number one recommendation usually to people. We say, hey, I've got a raccoon that's not moving, it's not acting right in my yard. Well, okay, don't go near it. Don't let kids go near it. Animals, leave the animal, let it be. And contact a local trapper, which is local wildlife removal specialist. There's a few that are contracted and permitted. They're permitted through the agency to do that and practice that in Hamilton County. If it's incapacitated and can't move, or it's in their home, if someone's got it captive, picked it up and taken it, which actually is it's against the law in the state of Tennessee to have any animal in your possession, any wild animal, any native animal to have in your possession. So we'll probably come out and ask to have the animal receipted over to us. And whether or not we charge that person is not necessarily the issue. We're more concerned with the safety and the health and protection of the public, because I've had cases where, I've had the baby raccoon in my house with my two-year-old. I don't know. Has your two-year-old been playing with it? Well, yeah, it's been holding it and things, because they're real cute and cuddly like a lamb. When a two-year-old doesn't know any better. So we're faced with challenges at times. We have our protocols that we follow. We're faced with challenges at times. Those morph into something that hybrid, so we have to take a different role. And like I said, the number one recommendation is always let wild animals be wild. And don't touch them is what we tell those people. But when wild animals merge and come in contact with people, we have to have those protocols, and we have to say, okay, we need to either get the health department involved, or no, we can just call your damage control permittee, whoever's going to come in, whoever's going to come remove the animal, let them come get it out of your house. But like I mentioned earlier, it's a lot about education. Either leave it alone or educate those people that, hey, enjoy it from a distance, and it's going to be okay. If it's just coming through, it's going to get in your garbage. Just hide your garbage. Close up all the holes in your house. That way those animals and you don't come together and don't interact when you don't want them to.
You're going to do a lot of people who still feed squirrels, raccoons,
yes,
etc.?
Yes, people feed wild animals year-round. And usually will end up having what they call as a problem. The biggest one I see in certain areas is bird feeders. People like to see our various many kinds and species of birds in this area in Tennessee. And what they don't realize is they may be attracting bears to their yard. And they say, well, what is a bear? I said, well, bears are omnivores. They don't eat meat. They'll eat bird seed. They'll eat your garbage. They like sweets, so they'll eat the bird feeder. So then they want to attract a pretty bird species to view, to see, and in turn they're attracting something that's going to give them a problem. So we see that a lot, where people feed animals and end up attracting and creating a problem between the humans and wildlife.
Michael, feeding, good idea, bad idea from the point of urban biodiversity?
Well, bad. It's bad. Yeah, I think wild animals are great, and I think people should appreciate them, obviously. But what it does is it just, I come at this more from an ecological perspective, but from a natural behavior perspective, it's unnatural for an animal to be fed. And it basically takes away a lot of its adaptation to the world. It doesn't, it forgets how to hunt. It forgets how to behave naturally. And I'm talking about birds and mammals and just about anything else. So I think it's bad. Yeah, almost universally a bad idea. He's got it.
A lot of people are going to be, a lot of the people who sell birdseed are not going to be happy with that. Question?
I came in late, so maybe you've already covered this, but what role do coyotes play, I guess, in the local urban
environment? We haven't really. That's a good question. Question is, what role do, where do coyotes fit in an urban ecosystem?
You have them around here. I come from Boston. We have them all over the place, and people always think of coyotes as a Western species. They're in every community in Boston.
Yeah, we have them around in southeastern urban Wisconsin too.
Yes, the I mentioned the raccoon calls were probably present, but the coyote calls take second place. They play their role. They prey upon all of our smaller animals. Houses that have a lot of rats or something, they may not have as many if they've got a good coyote population around. Rabbits and squirrels, things that gnaw on wires or cars that may cause some damage and cause some problems rarely.
Geese,
they will prey upon geese at times. So when geese go through their phase of molting, when they cannot fly, that's what we mentioned earlier, you may be in the room about how grass and yards are cut short and they can see predators. They love that. They'll stay around water when they're molting because they can't fly. But if a coyote can get near them, and they're usually a late evening, nighttime hunter, you know, they hopefully, if they can get a hold of a geese, they do. So they have their place, but they can be very prolific breeders at times, depending on the size of the pack and the food resources that they have, that they can access to if they've got a lot of food to eat. They can have a healthy population, and the population here now is healthy. We strive with a constant management problem, the what to do, whether to scare them off. Sometimes people say, well, I'm thinking, I don't want coyotes around, but I thought about getting a dog. Will that work? Yeah, I said, yes. A large dog, such as Labs, German Shepherds, 50 pounds or larger, will usually keep a coyote at bay. Normally, coyotes don't cross into people's yards and such, but they do have their place. They do prey upon certain species and keep those animals and populations down. For the state, better.
Yeah, for the whole ecosystem.
Okay.
Are they a positive influence?
Yes, I'd say they are a positive influence.
I would agree with that. If we did a study and looked at the stomach contents of coyotes in the Knoxville area, and it was largely feral cats. Oh. And the cat population is just out of control. It's killing. They kill billions of songbirds every year. So anything that can keep that population down, they're doing us a favor.
Where I live, that's the principal complaint about them is, a coyote eat my cat or something. So they want the police to kill the coyotes. So,
uh-huh.
So the wild is
free from
the cats to go chase birds.
So where are the coyotes fitting in the ecosystem? Did they take the place of a different predator, or are they just sort of moving along after following their food supply?
Well, both, really. I mean, the ecosystem in the city is already really distorted and disturbed and unnatural anyway, so they kind of come in and they're playing an important role. I mean, that's nature's way, right? And when there's that many cats running around, and of course the Humane Society, kills millions of cats every year. It's just crazy. There's a food source there with all those cats, and a coyote, you might say, is nature's way of kind of putting that balance back. And because the cat population, like I say, is wreaking havoc with birds and squirrels and other populations, so I think they play an important role.
So, did they replace a different predator though, the coyotes, or?
No, they. I would say they rank in here in Tennessee. They would rank. Pretty high up on the food chain, as well as one of our top predators for the state here. We don't, besides the bobcat and the coyote, like he had mentioned, the feral cats and things that they keep in check, they are very beneficial for what they do. I mean, without those, and in certain areas, we're going to have an influx of population of things that we need something to prey upon, those other species.
No, I think an interesting way to elaborate on that is you've probably heard about the wolf reintroduction program, and they try that in the Smokies too with the red wolf. A lot of ecologists will argue that the wolves should be reintroduced to help keep the coyotes in check, because wolves definitely prey heavily on coyotes. And so where they do that in the western states, that does help keep down the coyote population. And one of the arguments is that it makes the farmers happy because there are fewer coyotes eating the chickens and the small game. Of course, the wolf has another set of problems associated with it. But a lot of people argue that that set of problems is less than the benefits.
What problems, aside from eating your lambs?
Exactly. That's pretty much it. I mean, most of the people who complain about wolves are farmers who argue they don't want them eating their farm animals. But the flip side of that is that they also help the farmers because they eat foxes and coyotes that probably eat more from livestock anyway.
Yeah, and you don't have. You said they tried red wolves here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but they haven't taken yet, or they're not. Okay.
It wasn't successful.
Not successful, okay. Because I know Wisconsin just started a wolf hunt because its population hit the management goal, and there's a fair bit of controversy over whether who's going to dictate whether this happens. It's the state or the federal government. Gentleman in back first, I think, who had his hand up first.
Well, I might support your point on the wolf hunt. Michigan's DNR has just sold, it's well over 1,000 licenses for its first great wolf hunt, which is limited to a take of about 60 or so animals. And it's a political debate. There was a ballot proposal in the legislature to back in and run, and now they're looking for another ballot proposal. But in the meantime, what's turned out is that the complaints, the predation complaints, have been one or two people who lost one or two lambs or dogs in the Upper Peninsula, and it's led to this whole fury over science and politics and legislative response, and it's bizarre. I haven't figured out, for example, how with 1,000 people with permits, they're going to all magically know, well, they're supposed to call every morning, I guess. Yep, we reached the limit. It's a bizarre mix to me of a small problem for a small number of people, magnified by public fears and misperceptions that then the politicians play upon. And the regulatory agency just kind of goes along with the politics, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about the Wisconsin situation to see it. If it's the same mix of factors or not, it led to a season there.
It is kind of, yeah. And I think Michigan and Wisconsin are both in that same struggle with the federal government over who's going to get to say whether the wolves can be hunted. Yeah. Lady in front?
Yeah, I just wanted to see if I could follow up on why the red wolf population reintroduction failed in our state.
Oh, good question. The question is, why did the red wolf reintroduction not work?
I was told that the pups in Cades Cove didn't have enough food to eat. I do know that it was very successful in North Carolina, the Dismal Swamp down there. They're doing fine. But, I think it's because they just weren't that well adapted to higher elevations. They seem to do better in that low elevation habitat.
So what?
Sorry, the coyotes and the red wolves. I heard that harvest was an issue as well.
I don't know, Joe.
Yeah, that's a good question. We actually have a program here at the Chattanooga Nature Center. Mm-hmm. They have red wolves in captivity where they breed those to hopefully reintroduce those red wolves. And I don't know of the plans currently to whether we plan to reintroduce and try to reintroduce some here currently in the near future or not. But that's what I have been told and heard too, is the whether it be from the coyote displacement and the competition of the food resources, I believe is the majority of the issue, and the interaction or interbreeding of those two species. I don't know that we have a confirmation, so to speak, of that when reintroduced, that they will be bred out by the coyote species. So I'm not sure if they're, because from wolf to domestic dog to coyotes and red wolves, the gene alleles and the trait, it's so close, like 98%. The DNA from a domestic dog to a wolf is so close to each other. I mean, it's hard to to genetically even determine, well, you know, it's hard to see. It's not, there's not much of a difference there. So far as those two animals, I do not have that current information on that. I don't know if that's the cause. I don't know if it was just from competition, or if it was from the breeding of those two species, interbreeding, that would have created that fail in that reintroduction.
Okay. One of the things that actually I was going to ask our third panelist about too, and they, is the question of education, which has sort of circled around everything that we've been talking about here today. We know that groups like Ducks Unlimited and Whitetails Unlimited and Salmon Unlimited were all created by people who enjoyed hunting and fishing in the outdoors because they wanted something to catch, but also because they valued the environment that they operated in. And at least in Wisconsin, I know we've had complaints, or not complaints, but the people have pointed out that the number of licenses that are issued for hunting and fishing has been on a steady decline. So I ask you guys, where does the next generation of concerned conservation people come from? Although I don't know. I mean, you know, with Tennessee culture may be completely different from Wisconsin culture. Maybe you don't have any trouble getting people out in the field to hunt and fish. You tell me.
Well, that issue is definitely one that will raise eyebrows, and it raises concerns. For the agency, so to speak, and our management, if we lost our people that are out in the fields in the woods hunting and fishing, we're losing a huge management avenue. Most of our, like we said earlier, we have certain, I said earlier, in the cities, animals thrive in the cities with lack of predation, lack of fear of being preyed upon. Our main apex predator in the state is the black bear. Black bears don't necessarily actively hunt the white-tailed deer, but they do take out and take upon, prey upon sick deer or deers when the opportunity arises and things. So the numbers to get people to hunt and fish, education, practices to try to keep those numbers up. Take a child hunting, take them outdoors. We don't necessarily want to say, hey, this is all what it's about, but let's get out and enjoy nature. And this is a way of doing so, and a way of playing your part. Not so much just to get out and say, hey, we're out here to harvest something, to kill something. We're here to actively play and be a part of the management and conserve and keep our populations healthy, the biodiversity of the state of Tennessee. There's even TV shows. Major ones, the Duck Dynasty. Everybody, that's a huge one right now, Duck Dynasty. It really promotes the outdoor use, hunting and things, and even though there's some things in it that may be managementally wise or looked at it wise, well, that may not be so good for a management standpoint of view, but it does promote people to get outdoors, wear camouflage and grow beards. And and there's a lot of other shows and things that like to get at people outdoors. We try to have a lot of programs, bird watching programs and other things like that. And we have people and days where they can come out and outdoors, field days and things with our agency we try to educate the people that enjoying the outdoors necessarily is not just, you don't want to just see it through a TV, you don't want to just see it through binoculars. If you want to actually get out and become active in that, that's how we try to keep our hunting and fishing license sales up. We want people to be out there. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was going to add, he has a question for
us. Well, I was curious, based on that, following up on that, in terms of the revenue for the agency that you report, how much of that is supported by sales of licenses?
Yeah, question is how much of the TWRA's budget comes from the sales of hunting and fishing licenses?
Well, we've had several questions. I've had over the phone here lately, does the government shutdown affect us? Right. Are you guys still going to get to work? Are our WMAs open? Yes, they are. And because of the sales from hunting license, our revenue comes in from the sale of hunting license, fishing license, our boat registrations and renewals. as well as some of our acts where it would affect us a little bit, but some of our acts are our Dingell-Johnson Act and our Pittman-Robertson Act, where those funds come in from ammo sales and the purchase of hunting and fishing equipment. So the agency's main source of funding is coming in from federal grants, and then majority of it is coming from the sale of hunting and fishing licenses.
So over 50% comes from the field?
Yes, I would say at least 50 to 60% majority comes from out of the field and comes from the people.
So the decline in that obviously has a financial impact on the agency?
Yes, yes.
So, and also everything else that those monies go into, because that probably supports parks to a degree, I would think.
Here in the state, we're separate from
you're separate from
state
the parks.
Yes, okay. The Tennessee Wildlife Resource Agency is actually separate from the state parks, but the management of those WMAs, the programs, the things that we offer the public, although their money is essentially coming back to them through that.
As I'm following up on the Michigan case, there are a lot of states that use overselling licenses just as a fundraising initiative.
Okay.
To get more money into the agency. And with some agencies have been accused of being overzealous and selling licenses for the ecological effect because they're more interested in
Michael, you had a point, I think.
Yeah, I think to address the question of where the next generation of conservationists is going to come from, I think that's a really good one. I think it sort of reflects why we're here today, because I think what we have is a society that's becoming increasingly urbanized. I mean, 80% of us live in cities. We're moving out of the countryside. And so I think if we have another generation of conservationists, it's going to be city kids who are educated probably in or around the city. And what I see to reflect that is the growth of urban nature centers. Like we have IAMS Nature Center in Knoxville that does a really great job of bringing in eagles for kids to see and school kids. But also I see the urban wilderness movement. We have in our city we have a really progressive mayor, and we have an urban wilderness area where a lot of kids go and they ride bikes and they hike, and to them that's nature. They don't get in the car and drive 20 miles and necessarily do the traditional things. They ride their dirt bikes in South Knoxville in these urban wilderness areas, and to them it's just as important as the traditional ways of hunting.
How large are these, and I mean, are they set up to be diverse?
No, they're not, to be honest with you. I think that's where this kind of discussion needs to come in. I think, you know, right now these urban wilderness areas are just your typical kudzu and, you know, just undeveloped inner city areas that are just overgrown with weeds. But to them, it's a wilderness, and that's where they experience. And you do have, obviously, some wildlife. You have the things we've been talking about, like the raccoons and skunks and birds. So to them, it is nature. But it's increasingly, I think, it's an urban kind of nature, which is why I think this is such an important topic.
Hmm. Question.
How would you characterize the difference between an urban wildlife situation and a suburban wildlife? I live in the suburbs, and we're pretty close to the open, the wildlife interface. So
yeah.
That makes a difference, and I'm just wondering, how does that look for you?
Good question. Question is, how do you differentiate between what is an urban wildlife area and a suburban wildlife area? Go ahead.
Typically, in my experience, the suburban areas still have some remnants of the original ecosystem intact. So you have the suburbs growing out into the wild matrix, and you still have some remnant forests and some remnant game and some remnant species. If you take South Knoxville, that urbanizing wilderness, that's basically a derelict area that's been there and abandoned for, you know, decades. And I guess the short answer is the urban areas have much, much more in the way of non-native invasive species. The suburban areas still have some of the natives that are still hanging around.
So at what point does that tip one way or the other? I mean, is it the amount of pavement that cuts out the natives? Is it just people planting non-natives that tilts the ecosystem into its urban characteristic?
All the above, sure. Yeah, it's just, I mean, anytime you have a suburbanizing area, you're running into people moving.
call it strictly density, or what the people do with it? Because you've drawn a couple of parallels over the course of our talk this morning with Europe, where things are a little different, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's definitely density, and then, you know, concrete per square mile is a huge factor. I mean, one thing we can all agree on is that concrete's really bad for biodiversity, and the more of it you have, the less of it you're going to have. I bring in the European example because I have colleagues who work in this area, and they have a very different mindset about all this, because they've experienced this for a longer period of time. And I think Americans are just getting used to the idea that nature is not infinite, and that we do have limits. And in Europe, it's a different mindset. It's like, okay, these cities have been here for hundreds of years. Let's bring nature back to the city, right? And it's kind of a big movement over there.
Is there any difference between concrete and pervious pavement, which I know is a thing in urban design now?
Sure. It's pervious pavement, of course, is where the rainwater goes into the groundwater supply, and it's really great. It definitely reduces runoff and helps groundwater recharge.
Does it change your concrete per square mile problem with urban areas?
Well, not in terms of habitat. It's still very poor habitat. It's still basically, you don't have plants, you don't have the base of the food chain, and you basically are still going to have a biological desert. So it's more from what they call ecological engineering perspective. Doesn't really help with wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Question?
I was talking a little bit about the black bears and thinking about human and species interaction. A lot of things that we see in Tennessee and in Appalachia in general is we've got the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and the black bears there. But immediately outside of the park, we've developed all around it, and so we've got Pigeon Forge and Gatlinburg, which are tourist destinations, extremely dense, lots of pavement, lots of lights, and we're seeing these black bears, now the population is healthy, come out into the Pigeon Forge area. We've also, on the flip side, got the Appalachian Bear Rescue that takes in these cubs, raises them to re-release them. So can you talk a little bit about that struggle of maintaining these bear populations, because in the Great Smoky Mountains, it's the number one visited national park, so we've got to have our cuddlies. But then there's the, you know, issue of the economic side, and then the issue of conservation. So can y'all speak to that?
So the question to summarize is, how do you keep the bear population healthy against encroaching suburbia or encroaching tourist areas? Is that fair?
Curiosity of those bears. I mean, because there are videos of bears walking down the middle of Pigeon Forge, and all the people are like, oh, cool, let me get a bear experience. And then we have the issue of all coming in and having to either put down the bear if it attacks an individual, and the only thing that bear did was eat the food that somebody was stupid enough to put in their 2-year-old's hand and get to the bed. An issue.
Go ahead.
Well, hopefully I'll get your question answered best I can here. It's a really good question, and it's actively going on all the time. Of course, wildlife, ecosystems and things were here first. Okay, so our bears were there first, and then our human encroachment, the urban sprawl, the, you know, the creation of the cities and the streets and the concrete and everything came along. The challenge on that is, of course, bears are curious. Everyone may have heard, don't feed the bears. We mentioned earlier, feeding wildlife, I will agree that it is wrong, it is bad. It takes away natural habits, natural ranges of movement across their habitat, the urge to hunt for food. They learn that if I get a free meal over here and it's easy, I don't have to fight for it. I don't have to do anything for it. So they're going to come to areas where they've learned that. Most of the time, we want to either try to scare a bear off, trap, relocate. We usually wait. People here in Hamilton County, for instance, we have a small population around this area. The Little Debbie factory. And listen, you know, they're attracted to that area because of the smell of the Little Debbie factory. So there's a few encounters there. And encourage those people, when they see them, to let it be a bear and let it move through and do its natural thing. Try to take away all of it, your garbage, your food, your bird feeders, so it can actually just come through naturally. A bear has a fairly a large home range that they'll move through. So, and when encounters happen, say in Gatlinburg or there, we usually, however the people call us up, whatever they report. Well, I saw it, and it was just digging around in the ditch, or it was digging around outside of the road. That's fine, and our management practice is to just let it be alone. When it crosses over into, well, we came in contact with each other, and it got aggressive, or when we have them that people put that food out, and they learn that, okay, I see a person, I'm going to go get food. Yes, we either have to come out and put down. Our challenge is, again, education to people to try to keep so we can coexist, so our cities and our people can enjoy our Gatlinburg, enjoy the Great Smoky Mountains, to say if you see bears, try to leave them alone. Let them be as natural as possible. One of the main things in wildlife management is to let it be alone, and it will kind of take care of itself. Those animals are used to histories, a long history of natural movements, natural predation upon things, places to go to breed, to food, water, and cover, places to sleep, places to eat, places to roam around. And those places, those where they come into contact with problems is when they come in contact with people and unnatural things such as that food placed out, such as garbage, such as things that they can, that they're given that's not a natural occurrence to them. So that's one of the big forefronts that we try to do is don't feed the bears, because that's going to create an adverse behavior reaction. Okay.
Go on.
I think I really want to put in a plug for something called the Wildlands Project here. I don't know if you've heard of it, but a lot of what we've talked about over the last hour is just talking about solving an immediate problem, like don't feed the bears. The reality is that these bears are going to reproduce. Their population is growing, and it's going to continue to grow, and you're either going to have to practice birth control or you're going to have to find a long-term solution, because the key point is that these parks are being completely surrounded by development. And so unless something changes, we're just going to have these little isolated pockets of nature surrounded by concrete. And these discussions will go on forever. Mm-hmm. The Wildlands Project is what the Society of Conservation Biology came up with, which is basically wildlife corridors. And it basically says, look, this is the way that it used to be. This is what these animals are used to. They need to migrate. They're going to reproduce and hunt. It's going to happen. And the Wildlands Project is a project to set up connected corridors between these parks and cities and areas. So basically revert things back to the way they used to be. And that's really what we need to do if we're going to have a long-term solution. And so it's not realistic, and because of politics, it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. But from a conservation science perspective, that's what you have to have. Not just, you know, little culture petri dishes of biodiversity that are surrounded by concrete and then having these continual conflicts with people.
Well, and then the question is, if you have, how long would those petri dishes even survive if they're not connected?
Sure.
Right?
Well, you have gene pool. Well, you could always have people who could go get the bears and bring them in and breed them like they do with zoos, but it's not a very natural situation.
Mm-hmm. Matt, could I add something to our, back to her question, sure, too, to add more to that? Our bear reserve up there, or our bear rehabilitation program in the Appalachian Teleco, they will take orphan cubs, or they take injured cubs, so to speak, or injured bear. The main thing is a cub. If they can take that, if the mother was hit by a car, killed, one of our major practices, they'll take that while they rehabilitate it. I want to add that they're enclosed, but they are hidden by that large fence. I don't know if you've been there or seen it. They're hidden by that fence, so what they're doing is trying to feed them where there is no impact. They don't understand that people are feeding them. And so when we introduce those, they hopefully will seek out their natural feeding habits. Yes, food was given to them because they're in an enclosed area and couldn't roam to get free food, but hopefully, you know, they don't associate people with food.
Yeah, that's something I really appreciate about ABR is the Appalachian Bear Rescue. They're very,
yes,
it's like one person is out up there. They may see the bear, and they do not let people come up, and it's very, very
strict. Is there a do you have a spectrum of control measures with bears? I mean, do you have a, you know, do you first try to discourage before you eventually get to the point of shooting the bear or trapping the bear?
Yes, always. There's a, of course, it's even always in debate and changing our matrix on what and how your protocol is affecting a call, bear call on an encounter. Like I mentioned, I was kind of going through it a little bit, maybe not clear, but sight of a bear, enjoy. If a bear's, okay, bear's getting in your garbage, okay, we may come out and it all the way to a certain point where we'll start an active measurement, whether we shoot it with a rubber bullet, which will just scare it away from that area, or they use like a paintball gun mark or something to make loud noise, something to scare the animal before, which is the last measure. It goes all the way from letting it be to the last measures if it attacks somebody to hunting the bear down and pick it down.
Okay. Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about the wildlife project. Is that something that is a UT or is that national?
So there's something called the Society of Conservation Biologists, which is a professional society. And they basically came up with this plan, oh, maybe 10 years ago or so. And it was publicized. And as you might expect, it hasn't really gained much traction because what it would involve would be having states agree that we're going to have a corridor, you know, between, for example, the Everglades and Okefenokee in Georgia and then the Smokies, and letting those, you know, wildlife that wants to migrate between these parks. And so it hasn't really gone anywhere.
Well, actually, there was a previous series last year on the Florida wildlife park, which one guy was really looking at from, and he actually
Actually, within the states, there has been, and particularly Florida has invested pretty heavily in some of these corridor areas. Within. Florida's been usually cited as kind of the flagship example of where they've made the most progress. I don't really know of anything in Tennessee where they've talked about this kind of thing much, but
I don't recall.
Yeah. But it's a great idea scientifically, but it's politically obviously it's pretty tough. Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry to say that our hour and 15 minutes is almost gone. Do we have one more question? No. Okay. Well, then I'll ask you guys what I ask everybody in the interview. Any last thoughts that you'd like to throw in, or did you have a last question? Did I see your hand or not? No. Okay. Ben, any last thoughts that you'd like to toss in about everything we've talked about here this morning or something we haven't?
Well, I guess just on the big picture perspective, in the field of urban biodiversity, there's two big theories right now of where this is all going to go. You know, what's the future going to be like? It's called sharing or sparing. You've probably never heard of this unless you read the academic literature. But sharing says that the future of humanity and biodiversity is we're going to share land with other species, and that means our cities are going to be spread out, and we're going to have cities that are very conducive to wildlife. Sparing means that we're going to basically concentrate people in big cities and spare the countryside for wildlife. And it's a big debate right now, and they're doing lots of calculations to show how much biodiversity can be saved if we concentrate people in big cities and leave the wildlands alone, versus whether we spread people out and make those human settlements more conducive to wildlife. And there's really no clear evidence as to which is better for the biodiversity of this planet. I mean, personally, I think I would like to see concentrate people in areas and just leave the wildlands alone. But there's an argument to be made for that. But I think that's, if you really want to think about where all this is going to go, 14 billion people on this planet and how this is going to work out for wildlife, it's going to be somewhere between sharing or sparing, and that's the big debate right now.
Yeah, that along the same lines is my thought as well. When you sit down and you think of the big picture and in years to come, what is the outcome for our biodiversity and our populations, and you know, we have to find that balance. We have to find that, whether it be sharing or sparing, we have to find the best management practices in the current here and now to keep those populations healthy, but for the conservation and to survival. We have to find out what we will do as people being having the one of the largest footprints in the economic world. We've introduced a lot of things that impact our ecosystems and things. We usually are the, like I said earlier, things are left alone. They usually balance. They have a balance for themselves. So that's one of our largest challenges. We have our carrying capacity for the planet. And we have to learn out what the best type of management is for ourselves so we can keep everything around, I reckon, for the longest amount of time and keep in and be able to coexist with all that.
We haven't talked about the ethics of this, but it really is a measure of how good a species we are as whether or not we can exterminate everything on the planet or at least survive without exterminating everything else, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, tigers, pandas, rhinos, they're all going to be gone in a couple of decades, mm-hmm. probably. So what does that say about us?
Yeah, we are losing species, and we kind of have questions, and we look at the immediate future. I believe one of our species in peril is a bobwhite quail. There's a lot of people afraid it's going the way of the dodo bird. It's going to go out because of probably our urban sprawl and our loss of some of its habitat, key habitat, and invasive species. So
please thank you all for coming, I should say, and please do thank our panelists who took time out of their lives to come and talk to us today.
Thank you.